I would like to dedicate the upcoming broadcast to Doug Clark of Wichita, Kansas. Doug is a former paramedic who was treated for lymphoma back in 1999 and 2000. The chemotherapy damaged his liver. He is now on 30 medications a day. There's a possibility he's a candidate for a liver transplant, but he requires resources to be able to travel to KU Med to find out and potentially facilitate the transplant itself. There is a fundraising page on Doug's behalf. I've linked it in the description box of this broadcast. If you'd like to do some good for someone in need, donate just a few dollars to Doug Clark of Wichita, Kansas, and let's do some good today. And thank you.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
It is the month of April. We approach the Easter holiday. Easter falls on the 16th of this month. It's always interesting. I enjoy Easter. I mean, it's not really a holiday I follow, but you know, we'll go down to the store and buy some peeps. Do you eat those things? Easter peeps? I mean, they got to be the worst thing for you. Just straight up sugar. These hugely cheaply produced marshmallowy balls of bird-shaped sugar. But I love them. When I was a kid, we do the Easter egg hunts. We didn't do a whole lot with the Easter bunny. Of course, you know, we as Christians, not hugely aware that we were surrounding ourselves with pagan symbols. And they would have Easter sunrise church services, and we've all seen social media explode around the Easter holiday with people saying, "Praise the Lord, he is risen. Happy Easter, he is risen, he is risen." And I enjoy the sacrilegious kind of tweaks to those memes. There's one that says, "He is risen," and it shows the grave of Jesus Christ and the stone is rolled away. And instead of Jesus, it's the Pillsbury Doughboy. There's another parody out there that's titled Remedial Christian Parenting, and it's got a kid in an Easter bunny costume with an Easter basket and Easter eggs, and it says, "Are your children playing with Lucifer's testicles? The truth about Easter eggs." Thought that was funny. A meme that's been floating around for I don't know how long, as Jesus emerging from the empty tomb, and the caption says, "Fucking lag, took 3 days to respawn." They're the Easter cookies. They're like sugar cookies, and they're shaped like a hand. And then you put like a creamy center right where the nail holes are. So what is that? Is it jelly? I don't know. You got to see the photographs on Google. There's the meme that says, "Jesus, the original walking dead." There's another one that says, "This Easter, remember, Jesus was not a zombie. He was not mindless, nor did he consume anyone. Nor was he a white," which is a spirit, ghost, or other supernatural being. "Although his soul and intellect were intact, he was not a rotting corpse. He was not a vampire. While he transubstantiated wine into blood, he never drank it from a person. Jesus was not a ghost or a wraith. He was corporeal and still had his wounds. It is clear Jesus was a lich." A lich is created when a powerful magician or king, striving for eternal life, uses spells or rituals to bind his soul to his animated corpse and thereby achieves immortality. Liches are depicted as being clearly cadaverous, their bodies still bearing the wounds they received before their death. Liches often have the power of necromancy, which allow them to bring the dead back to life. Well, I don't know if I agree with that, because Jesus didn't require the animated corpse to have eternal life. He simply animated the corpse itself. He inhabited the physical body for a period of time. I guess the depictions of him do show nail holes in the hands and feet and the spear wound in the side. He continues to bear those wounds even as a deity, so maybe there's some merit to that. One of the big questions about Jesus and this debate rages in the non-theist culture, is the Jesus legend based on a real guy? Even if you don't believe in the God-man Jesus, the Jesus who was born of a virgin and did miracles on this earth, who transformed the loaves and fishes and changed the water into wine and healed the sick and made the blind to see and cured the leper and did all those things, was killed and crucified and rose again and ascended to heaven and one day shall return. Even if you don't believe in that, was the legend based on an actual dude? Well, that's the conversation we're going to have on the broadcast today as I speak with the author of a new book, David Fitzgerald, and his book, which just released. It's called Jesus, Mything in Action. We talk about the Jesus story from time to time on this broadcast because it's a conversation that continues to happen out there, and I find it a compelling one. I'm surrounded by literal Jesus believers. They believe in a Jesus. They pray to him at every meal. They pray to him before bedtime. They teach their kids to pray with them. They go to church on Sundays and Sunday nights and Wednesday nights to pray to Jesus and praise Jesus. They have Jesus t-shirts. They listen to Jesus music. They wear Jesus jewelry. It's Jesusville around here. But was there a Jesus in any sense who walked the earth 2,000 years ago? That's the conversation that we are going to have today. Next Tuesday is going to be an interesting, I think, a possibly controversial subject as we talk about recovery programs. And the show is called 12 Steps to Nowhere. Now, don't come after me for the title. I realize there are those who have entered recovery programs, even religiously themed or higher power focused recovery programs, programs that have steps, and they have benefited from them. I realized you're going to find those who've entered almost any kind of program, and they may come out claiming that they were better. But are these really effective? Is Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step or step-based programs, are they really the best way to defeat addiction? What's the track record? What do the statistics say? What's some of the baggage that comes when you enter a potentially woo-based recovery program? They're talking about putting your trust elsewhere. You can't do it on your own. You can't beat addiction without a higher power. What are some of the negatives that come with this kind of thinking, this kind of mindset, these kinds of practices? That's what next Tuesday's show is going to be. We're going to get into some of the data revolving around 12-step programs, and we're going to talk about some secular alternatives. And if you want to sound off on this subject, my email is podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Today's broadcast is about Jesus. Now, beyond the conversation that we're having today with historical researcher David Fitzgerald, I want to encourage you to check out Dr. Bart Ehrman's lecture series, How Jesus Became God, at the Great Courses Plus. Now, Ehrman gets into the many historical claims about the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus Christ that simply cannot be historically verified. The differing characteristics of a supposedly unchanging Christ, as written about in the different Gospels, the Council of Nicaea, so much more interesting stuff. The Great Courses Plus has a wealth of knowledge, over 8,000 lecture series from renowned educators, streaming right to your computer, your tablet, your TV, or smartphone, on a host of topics, from religion to science to language to health to fitness to economics to travel to hobbies and interests, so much more. And my listeners get a free trial of The Great Courses Plus. Just sign up through my special URL to start watching, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Get your free trial. You will love it. Sign up today at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. My guest on the show today, David Fitzgerald, is an author and an activist and a public speaker. You might have seen him give some presentations at free thought events around the country. He's written a few books, including a book on the Mormons as part of his Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion series. He's also the author of Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. That book came out in 2010, and we're going to talk today about an elaboration on the exploration into whether or not there was a legitimate Jesus. And I always enjoy talking to Dave. It's great to have you back on the show, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Always glad to be here.
How do I introduce you? I always say historical researcher, which of course sounds very lofty, but I mean, author, how do you normally introduce yourself?
Author's great. Historical writer is great. I try to stay away from the word historian because then it opens all this can of worms about, oh, you're not a real historian, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not. You know, I'm just a writer who reports on historical matters.
Well, have you just discredited yourself as a source on what we're about to talk about when you say I'm not a historian? Because
well,
that's
that
they're going to come after you, David, is my point, right?
They will anyway. But I've been saying that for 17 years. It's like, you know, hey, these aren't my ideas. I'm just the combat reporter from the trenches.
And you have a gift for it. You're able to put a lot of these things together, and they're referenced. So as we're speaking on the show today, we encourage everybody, let's go after the ideas, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, that goes for both sides of the debate on historicity. Like, there's so many people out there who are just fed up, and it's like, oh, my God, Jesus mythicism again. And the point I want to make is that this is an important point to make whether Jesus is real or not. That's not even the real issue. The issue is how much can we know for sure about Jesus? And that is a win for atheists no matter which side of this debate comes out.
I'm waiting already for the comment section, the barrage of people who say, well, where's Bart Ehrman? Where's a historicist? How come you don't have balance on this show? Well, first of all, I can't get Ehrman to agree to do the show. I'm sure he's a busy guy. I gave it a shot, right?
Fair enough. And you know what? I love Bart Ehrman. Yeah, as you probably know, I just disagree with him on the historicity issue. And the beautiful thing is Bart Ehrman is not the enemy. Historicists are not the enemy. Even Christians aren't the enemy. Bullshit is the enemy.
That's a t-shirt. Bullshit is the enemy, David Fitzgerald. I'll put that on my website and clean up. Of course, you and I deal all the time, though, David, with people who were like, well, of course, I was in conversation just a few weeks ago with someone. She's a devout Catholic, and so she's curious about me. And I'm talking about the fact that I'm not a believer in Jesus. And she's like, well, of course, there's no question that there was an actual person, that Jesus, that walked the earth. I mean, to her, the issue is solved and settled. And we run into this quite a bit, a little less than we used to, but it's still kind of a prevailing wind out there, isn't it?
It so is. And that's the thing that, you know, I don't mind that getting that from Christians. It's when I get it from atheists, when they inherit the exact same head in the sand, oh, I'm so sure it's real, and that smug dismissal, that drives me crazy. And the thing of it is like, it's not that I think this is an important issue. It's not that I think it really matters one way or the other, whether Jesus existed or not. But the fact is, if you do worship Jesus, you should know if he existed or not. You should be curious about this subject. The great thing for atheists, Jesus mythicism, the more you look into that, the more you can call the bluff of anybody who tells you that they know how Jesus thinks or behaves or taught or wants you to vote.
I'm going to saddle the other elephant in the room here very quickly. Yes, again, we're talking about Christianity. Now, of course, I realize we're not in the pleasing everyone business, but every time we address Christianity here in the hugely religiously Christian United States of America, I mean, what, 3/4 of the population embraces some flavor of Christianity? They're like, well, how come you're not talking about cults? Or how come you're not talking about Islam? Or how come you're not doing this or that? And I'm like, well, you know, we talk about those things, but Christianity is sort of what we're dealing with. It's what the elected officials are trying to shove through
That's the big difference. It's like if the Hare Krishnas were running our political establishment, then yeah, I'd be more worried about Hinduism. But the fact is, it's Christians who are the biggest threat to atheists in America.
You've written the book Nailed, 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. And I'll be shameless and say that I recommend the book a lot because it's easy to digest. It's a fast read, relatively. I mean, there's a lot that went into it, but it's not overwhelming. Like Carrier's On the Historicity is a great book, but it is not one that that you open lightly, right? It's not a bathroom reader.
Well said. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it is an awesome book, along with Raphael Lassiter and Robert Price. Those are all great books to get into. But yeah, as far as a nice introduction, I think that's where Nailed really flew. The problem with Nailed is it talks about the top 10 ways that Jesus' story just fails the reality test. But it doesn't talk about much about where I think Christianity really did come from or my evidence for that. And so that's why I've spent the last 3 years working on the follow-up book to Nailed, Jesus Mything in Action. there were so many questions that I got and pushback that I got from our fellow atheists who were assuring me, oh, no. I know there wasn't, you know, a divine super son of God, Jesus, but there was a real guy named Jesus.
That's my starting point. A charismatic guy, right? A charismatic preacher. He walked the shores of Galilee, and certainly the myth, the legend is based on the man. This is where most people begin the conversation, and to that you say what?
Well, that's where I started the conversation too. I mean, 15 years ago, 17 years ago, it never had even crossed my mind that there might not be a Jesus. And it wasn't until I started getting curious about, you know, I wonder how much of this in the Gospels we can be sure that he said and did, and how much of it is just legendary bullshit that got edited on later by later editors. And the problem with that process is once you try to parse those two things out, you realize how bad our evidence is for Jesus and how little there is of it. And even the little bit we have is questionable. It's not just the big mythological items that he does that's causing questions. It's even the mundane, everyday things that he did that gets called in question.
But Josephus and Tacitus, I mean, come on. I mean, I hear the names tossed out almost in sequence. How do you address that?
Well, I do address it. I literally do address it. I talk about what Tacitus says and when he said it, and I talk about what Josephus said and what he didn't say. And all these other sources for Jesus inside the Gospels, inside the New Testament, and outside the New Testament. That's why this book is so big. In fact, I originally meant it to be book two in the Hitchhiker, not the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in the Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion series. And it turned out at the end of the day, when I was done, it was almost 900 pages. So it's actually now three books instead of one.
Tacitus, not even an eyewitness to Jesus, correct?
Right. And when you look at people like Tacitus, like Suetonius, all these other people who get trotted out as eyewitnesses to Jesus, in most cases, they're not even witnesses to Jesus. They're talking about Christianity in the second or third century. And nobody doubts that there were Christians at that time. And those few times when people say, oh, well, Tacitus confirms such and such, most of the time, they're just describing something that any Christian off the street can tell them. And they don't cite any sources for this. They don't say, oh, I went back into the archives and hunted this down to make this point about something I'm talking about in passing. You know, they're not interested in Christianity. They're not interested in Jesus. They're not researching this stuff.
Josephus in the Antiquities, what is that, 80 AD-ish? I mean, what are we talking about
the year 90 or so.
Okay.
And the reason that Josephus's testimonium is so important is because – if you take away that, if that turns out to be a forgery or not mentioning Jesus, and that's exactly what I think the case is, that means that Christians have absolutely nothing to corroborate the New Testament for the entire first century.
Now, why do you think it's a forgery?
Well, there's no question that it's a forgery. The testimony is a forgery. The question has fallen back to, well, how much of it is a forgery? Nobody doubts that at the very best, Josephus wrote something and Christians embellished it or pumped it up. But I think there's better arguments that the entire paragraph, and when I say entire paragraph, it's a tiny paragraph tucked into a chapter that's otherwise talking about other things. When you take that out, there's no break in the narrative. It completely flows better without it. And again, that's just the tip of the iceberg. The big tipping point for me, the big red flag for me, is that for 300 years, no other Christian quotes this, even though they constantly quote Josephus for evidence on people like John the Baptist. And yet this ace in the hole that would have been total proof of having Jesus, no one thinks to use that until the person that we are accused of being the forger, Eusebius of Caesarea.
Where would Josephus have gotten the information in the year 90 AD? I don't get that.
You know, it's funny because Bart Ehrman makes that point that even if every single word of the testimonium is real, all it's saying is what you could have learned from a Christian on the street. It really doesn't add anything plus or minus to the equation, to the argument.
The Gospels talking about Jesus. Do we get into the origins of the Gospels, the authorship of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John?
I mean, we don't. There's not that much we can know about who they were, but we can know a lot about what kind of person they were, what they knew, and who their sources were. And now, the more you look into it, the more all our sources for all, not just our Gospels, but all the Gospels that got written by other Christians that never made it into the New Testament, all these Gospels ultimately trace back to one Gospel. That's the Gospel of Mark, our most no-frills, low-budget, low-rent Jesus. And the story just expands from there.
You talk about several different types of Jesuses. I mean, every gospel has a different flavor of Jesus. You want to elaborate on that for me?
Yeah, we start out with this very human, fallible, suffering Jesus in Mark, who seems to be written just to give Christians a reason why Jesus didn't come back and save everyone after the war with Rome in AD 70. The story he tells gives this allegorical spin on a Jesus that before the Gospels were written, he doesn't have a life. He doesn't have teachings. He doesn't have a biography. There's mythology about him. And all the things we see from Paul's writings, from the Christians who are writing around the same time as Paul, from the book of Hebrews, they're describing a Jesus that's completely different from the Gospels' Jesus.
In what way?
He's off Earth. He's not on the planet. He's in heaven. He's at the dawn of creation. Everything he does is big and mythological and not here on Earth, and not certainly not in a flesh and blood earthly setting.
The Jesus story then comes from where? I mean, if it wasn't based on an actual charismatic preacher who walked the earth, what are we talking about?
Well, I want to say right off the bat, that was my go-to. I just assumed it was. And there's nothing implausible about Jesus being based on a real person. But the problem is, our evidence doesn't point to that. Our evidence points to the first Christians worshiping a mystery faith deity, a Jewish version of the all these other Hellenistic mystery faith deities that were so popular at the time. Early Christianity looks just like the local Jewish version of that. When you get Mark and Matthew, Luke and John written decades later, at least generations later, starting in the 70s and mostly into the second century, you've got a figure who suddenly goes from being an allegory to an expanded biography. All the details, all the teachings, all the deeds that he does, those come out starting with Mark, the author that we call Mark.
When we look into the Old Testament, we see stories like the Abraham-Isaac story. And of course, Isaac is supposed to be kind of a representation of what Jesus will eventually do in the New Testament, right? The sacrifice of the Son. And there are a lot of those types of connections, Old and New Testament. Well, if the New Testament was not true, how come there were so many obvious references in the Old Testament to the coming of Jesus? And
yeah, it always amazed me how they're able to just spin gold out of the Old Testament. For instance, the one I love the best is in the Adam and Eve story, man will put his heel down upon you, snake, and your head and crush you. And it's like, oh, that's so obviously talking about Jesus. It's like, really? Really? Is that what that's talking about?
How they get Jesus out of that, I do not know.
Or there's some other things where one of the patriarchs, I think, who is it? Is it Joshua who raises his hands or Moses raises his hands while they're having a battle? And as long as his hands are kept up, they win the battle.
I don't think it was Moses.
I want to say Joshua, but
yeah,
anyway.
I have to look it up.
But anyway, it's like, well, he had his hands out just like Jesus did on the cross. It's like, holy crap.
Do you see the prophecy card played quite a bit? You know, his birth, his death, all prophesied in the Old Testament.
And it's amazing how dead on the prophecy is when you can write your story based around the prophecy.
Now, you think that's the case? You think the writers of the New Testament were using the Old Testament as kind of a primer or what?
Yeah, actually, that's not even controversial anymore. I mean, Mark fills Old Testament prophecies throughout his Gospels without calling attention to the fact. Matthew does the same thing, only he points chapter and verse and says, oh, and this is according to the prophet where it was written this. You know, chapter and verse, though he keeps making mistakes like quoting the wrong prophecy, quoting something as a prophecy that's not a prophecy, or quoting something as a prophecy that doesn't exist and we've never been able to find what he's talking about.
You mentioned some of the gospels that aren't part of the current canon of the Christian Bible. What are some of those gospels and where did they end up?
We're talking about things like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, and any number of all these other Gnostic gospels. Most of them came out of the second century. Some of them may predate our gospels. The oldest gospel text we have is a fragment of a gospel we don't recognize it from. It's about Jesus doing a miracle on the shores of the Jordan River. And it doesn't come from any gospel that we have. But that's our oldest surviving gospel text, older by far than any of our existing New Testament gospel texts. So we know there was this huge canon of literature. There was a whole genre of infancy gospels where like Robert Price has made the analogy that you have these Superman comics, but they wonder, well, what was Superboy's life like in Smallville? So you get The Adventures of Superboy. And we get the same thing with Jesus. We've got stories about Jesus turning clay birds into real birds and killing his schoolmates by touch and, you know, terrifying everybody in Bethlehem or Nazareth and wishing people into the cornfield, that kind of thing. Just sort of a Jesus / Damien type character.
Well, it is a kind of a big mystery. Jesus in his teen years and 20s. I mean, you get a few little morsels, but there's really not much elaboration in the Gospels we have.
We really only have one story like that that's made it into the Gospel, and that's the scene in Luke when he is a young boy and goes to the temple in Jerusalem and hangs out with the rabbis teaching them.
Yeah.
That's a story that came from one of these infancy Gospels. But Christians from like the 2nd century and the 3rd century, they would think we were only like half Christians because we don't have any of these stories anymore. Very few of those have survived.
So what determines the canon we have today as opposed to some of the other canons out there? What books are chosen and not? And who makes the decision, man?
Such great questions. Such awesome questions.
So, I mean, I wish I knew. I just don't.
Well, the thing is, nobody knows. And you could even argue that no one has still agreed on it because all the major Christian denominations – or not even denominations – all the major Christian orthodoxy, Catholicism, and Protestant – you know, flavors don't agree on what the canon is for the Bible.
So, I mean, are there different canons floating around even now? I mean, we've got the 66 books that I'm familiar with and most cultural Christians here in the United States are familiar with. Would you open a Bible in another country or in another even version of Christianity and they have books we don't have or what?
Exactly right. And when you go back to our earliest complete New Testament manuscripts, we've got the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus. Both of those books don't agree with each other. They each have books that the other doesn't have. And both of those books have books we don't have, and we have books neither of those have. So it's astoundingly complicated and convoluted, this process of creating a canon. And you could write a whole book just on that process. There is books about that, actually.
How did we get the current canon that you and I are familiar with? Where did that come from?
That came from what we call the Roman Catholic Church laying down the law. And of course, now our Roman Catholic canon is not quite the same as the Protestant canon. It's been an ongoing process for 2,000 years.
It's interesting to watch cultural Christians today as we talk about the literal stuff in the Bible. I mentioned this, I think, in the last show. We were talking about how the Bible speaks of a firmament that surrounds the earth and there's water up in space and the firmament
Water below it. Yeah.
So you mentioned these types of things in a Bible that's supposedly literally true. And they're like, well, that's not literally true. It's kind of a, you know, it's a good book with some good teachings in it. And I think, you know, if you were to say that a few centuries ago, they would have hauled your ass into the middle of the town square and burned you at the stake.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so true. And it is funny to think about that Christians today would be the heretics of 500 years ago.
They would take Joel Osteen down in Houston, Texas, you know, mega pastor who's teaching all this happy clappy stuff and kind of going soft on gays. I mean, I think he said in regard to homosexuality that it's, you know, it's not God's best, but God loves everyone. It's that kind of stuff, you know. And if you were to say that just a few hundred years ago, it's execution, public torture and execution for the man.
Yeah, it's not just for atheists anymore. Yep, absolutely.
So another argument I often hear, David Fitzgerald, is, well, if it's not true, how come it's been around for 2,000 years? The Bible is the most popular book ever printed. I mean, if there wasn't something to it, it wouldn't have the legs, right?
Tell that to the Hindus. They're on the
Colorado. Well, they got us beat by, 3,000 years, I think, with the Vedas, right?
Yeah, that's kind of crazy, yeah.
Well, I mean, the Bible is, though. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Christianity has managed to survive and thrive to a degree. I mean, it's dwindling here a little bit.
Well, you know, here's the thing about it. I mean, yeah, it's had a great run. I'll give you that. Christianity is the perfect textbook example of evolution in action because that thing has changed and mutated so many times throughout its existence that you could probably slice it up every 100 years, every generation or so, and you could hardly recognize it when you get to the end of the line for Christianity. The stuff that we have just dating back to the second century and the third century, 100 or 200 years after Christianity began, we've got this whole blackout period where we don't even know what they were preaching, but our earliest texts, we wouldn't even recognize it as Christianity, barely recognize it as Christianity.
Back to Jesus, which is the reason we're having this conversation.
Right.
If he wasn't necessarily, there's no evidence that he was based on a real person, and it's probably impossible at this measure to know. Where'd he come from? Is he a ripoff?
I like what Robert Price says about this. He says, for all extents and purposes, even if there was a real historical Jesus, there might as well not be one anymore, because all the information we have about who Jesus was and what he did and what he said, none of that is connected to a real person who lived in the first century. None of it.
And if you believe in the omnipotent, benevolent Jesus who watches from above and allows us to sort of flounder and ask, I mean, I was talking about the Shroud of Turin, I think, last week as well. Yeah. It's like, is it paint or is it blood? You know, it looks like it has a beard. I mean, we're sitting here fumbling in the dark looking for basics on the most critical question in the history of all humanity. And Jesus, who could solve the mystery right now, does nothing. He's got his, he's got William Lane Craig and other apologists arguing oral tradition. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, come on. Of course. Right. People were able to perfectly remember things when
you've got historians giving him psychological analysis. It's like, wow, that's a really good trick. Too.
Let's talk about oral tradition for just a second. This is one of the apologist arguments that for the accuracy of scripture in a time when few people could read or write. Can you flesh it out for me, Dave Fitzgerald?
Yes, I can try. Here's where I think that comes from. They have a paradigm of Jesus arrived, he had 12 disciples, and he passed on teachings to them. They passed it on to the Christians passed it on to the Gospels, and it all is a line, you know, leading back to Jesus. The problem with that is that what we have early Christianity that's very convoluted, not very well organized, not very coherent, and not much like what we think of as Christianity. Then you've got Christianity after the Gospels are written, and then the Jesus of those Gospels continues to grow. The story grows from that point on. They expect that there had to have been oral tradition to give us that Jesus. But from the mythicist point, what we're saying is that, no, it started with all these crazy stories, starting back with this allegory that Mark did. And that's why we can't, that's why we spent hundreds of years and three major, what they call quests for Jesus, trying to find the real Jesus. And every one of them has ended at a failure. And every one of them has ended with the saying, well, yeah, all these tools we've got, these criteria, they are failed. And it's not atheists who are saying it's failed. It's Christians who have thrown up their hands and say, yeah, this isn't working. I hadn't thought of that. Oh, yeah, that doesn't hold up.
On Netflix the other day, I think it was Netflix, I saw Bill Maher's Religulous was on. It's actually a very compelling, I mean, whether you like Bill Maher or not, I thought he did a great job, except for he zips into the zeitgeist thing for a short, brief moment when he makes the Horus connection, which is something I hear quite a bit.
That was unfortunate because it's like Jesus is not a cookie cutter of the mystery faiths. Christianity is a mystery faith.
Right. So someone says Horus or Mithras or something like that. It's not quite that easy, right?
Yeah, it's not quite that. It's not like the Christian said, well, what are we going to do? We need a God and we'll just take this God. They were making a Jewish version of the mystery faiths. I mean, it's more like Mormonism and Christianity. It's more that kind of spinoff where they were taking Jewish mysticism, Jewish intellectual circles, mixing it with Hellenistic philosophical ideas and coming up with a uniquely Jewish version of this Hellenistic philosophy, this theological construction.
How much of it is my God is bigger than your God? I'll go create or build or construct a God that could kick your God's ass kind of thing.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, when you look at what Jesus' teachings are, he teaches the best and worst of the first century and the second century. There's nothing really original about what he says. As much, you hear Christians say that constantly, oh, he was radical and totally unheard of. It's like, he didn't teach like the Pharisees did. And it's like, well, yeah, actually he did. In fact, he's stolen many of his teachings right from the Pharisees. And that's the stuff that doesn't conflict with itself. But it always amazes me to see some of the historical errors in the Gospels. For instance, we just talked about the Pharisees. In real life, the Pharisees would have loved somebody like Jesus. They hated the temple fat cats just as much as he does in the Gospels. Most of their teachings wind up in Jesus's mouth at some point in the Gospels. And yet in there, the anachronism we're seeing is that Pharisees clearly didn't like Christians, just the same way that John the Baptist's cult didn't like Christians. And so we're seeing those conflicts played out in the Gospel with a caricature of Pharisees and co-opted John the Baptist.
All right, well, lay the book out for me.
It's in three big sections. The first one looks at the myths of Jesus mythicism, what it is and what it isn't. I always constantly hear, like you said, the Bart Ehrman argument that, oh, no scholars agree that this is true. This is just a couple of people on the fringe. It's like, no, that's not true. And talking about what Christian bias still has sway over in biblical studies and academia. And to be honest with you, most of this argument should be between atheists. It should be between the secular historians and not the believing historians, because biblical historians who already have a religious commitment, they are going to go tooth and nail before they even admit there's a chance that Jesus might not exist.
Yeah, the information has to go through the filter of belief first, right?
Yeah, and we always get ragged on for having our atheist bias, but if you want to see a bias, I don't care if there was a Jesus or not. If it turns out tomorrow that we find some evidence of Jesus and it turns out he was a real guy, I'd be just as happy an atheist then. We don't need him to be a myth. They need him to not be a myth. And the problem with that is that he's a myth whether the mythicists are right or the historicists are right. I talk about that. I talk about what our sources are for Jesus and what they really say. The very last book, I do a thought experiment kind of along the lines of what Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson did with Cosmos, where they travel through space. I do a time travel expedition through Christian origins and Christian evolution. And it's a very fun book. I think it's going to be really invaluable for anybody on either side of the argument.
Now, with your permission, I would like the opportunity to share just sort of a tidbit of the book with my listeners. I'll just read from what portion would you prefer if I was to grab something out of Mything in Action?
I think the most fun for your listeners would be a section from book three, which is called The Gospel According to H.G. Wells. That's the time travel adventure into Christianity.
Okay, so you're cool with that if I was to take just a few paragraphs, just a sampling of the book and actually just present it so they can get a taste of what you've done, right?
Yeah, do it. I think you'll have fun too with that.
Okay, well, we'll be back in just a second. I'm going to read for you a portion of David Fitzgerald's new book, Jesus, Mything in Action. Dave Fitzgerald, thanks so much. You're always a great guest. It's been a pleasure, man.
Thank you, sir.
Back in a second with an excerpt from Jesus, Mything in Action. Hang on. A reminder that my supporters on Patreon get a commercial-free version of the broadcast and a bonus show every single month. Thank you so much for your support of any amount at patreon.com/SethAndrews. My guest, who I just spoke to in the previous segment, David Fitzgerald, has authored a new book called Jesus, Mything in Action. And it's a big book that is making a pretty compelling case that Jesus the God wasn't even based on Jesus a man, a fascinating topic that has long been argued by apologists of all shapes and stripes all across the planet for hundreds and hundreds of years. Well, David Fitzgerald has given me permission to read just a portion of the book. This will be from chapter 19. It's called The Invisible Man. This is just a taste of the book, Jesus, Mything in Action. It begins with a quote from H.G. Wells from The Time Machine. And the quote says this: "No, I cannot expect you to believe it. Take it as a lie or as a prophecy. Treat my assertion of its truth as a mere stroke of art to enhance its interest. And taking it as a story, what do you think of it?" And the chapter begins. If there was no Jesus, where did Christianity come from? I mentioned earlier that short of possessing a time machine, we'd never know all the details of Christianity's origins. So let's try that. We'll do for ancient history what Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson did for the universe in Cosmos, and take an imaginary trip back in time. First, of course, some caveats. All reconstructions of history are hypothetical. Though this is based on evidence that really exists, this gospel is fiction too. For this thought experiment, I'll strive to stick to what we know, making use of our available evidence. I'll avoid speculating as much as possible and try to refrain from taking too much dramatic license, our science fictional framing device accepted. And though this chapter admittedly risks oversimplifying complex issues, the truth is, that's inescapable. I have no doubt the origins of Christianity are even more convoluted and confused than we will ever know. Take a moment to picture your time machine. I suggest a cool, appropriately steampunky, classic well-style number decked out with lots of faintly glittering brass, ebony, ivory, and translucent glimmering quartz. Since this is a fictional exercise, we can pimp our ride with some Gallifreyan TARDIS circuitry to let us move through space and time. And while we're at it, let's take a note from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Now, I wasn't going to suggest bringing a towel, but do be sure to pop a babelfish in your ear for ancient language translation. And if you're a woman, you might want to pick up a fake beard a la Monty Python's Life of Brian. These are sexist times we're going to. If you don't already, we'll just have to pretend you can read Greek, Latin, various scripts of Aramaic, etc. Let's start by just setting aside everything we've learned so far and just assume that, yes, there totally was a real Jesus, and we're going to go find him. And though I'm sure you know this already, remember that we're using BCE and CE instead of BC and AD. Ready? Let's go find Jesus. And the next section begins with a subtitle, Hunting for Jesus. But first, where and when do we start looking for Jesus? We've already seen that competing accounts of his miraculous birth are problematic. Matthew's dark, scary account has him born and on the lam during Herod the Great's reign, so that has to be sometime before the year 4 BCE. But Luke's angst-free, happy nativity story has to take place sometime after the Roman annexation of Judea in 6 CE. Where else can we look? According to the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus appears to have had a year-long career beginning around the age of 30. That's out of Luke 3:23. A career which lasted until he came to Jerusalem for the first time in the last week of his life during Passover. There he kicked the money changers out of the temple, which leads directly to his execution. John's Gospel doesn't try very hard to sync up with the other three. His Jesus launches his career by popping down to Jerusalem and kicking out the money changers right after his first miracle in Cana, a career that spans at least 3 years and includes several trips to Jerusalem. This is already turning into a wild goose chase or a wild Jesus chase, and we haven't even started yet. So why can't we pin down his career chronology any better? After all, as I mentioned in Nailed, we know what day Cleopatra put an asp to her breast. It was August 12th, 30 BCE. We know what time Mount Vesuvius erupted and destroyed Pompeii, August 24th, 79 CE, between 2 and 3 in the afternoon. We know what day Julius Caesar forgot to beware the Ides of March and bumped into Brutus and friends. That was March 15th, 44 BCE. So why don't we know the actual date that Jesus died, or entered triumphantly into Jerusalem, or drove the money changers from the temple? Why don't we know the day or even the year of any event in Jesus' life? It gets worse. Incredibly, the early Christians didn't have any better idea than we do. In fact, their guesses were much worse. We learn from the late 2nd century church father Irenaeus, the same church father who first gives definite quotes from our familiar Gospels and pronounces them the only four Gospels that count, that many Christians thought Jesus lived to an old age before being crucified. Why would anyone think that? The reasoning he offers is a bit convoluted. First, since Jesus came to save everyone, infants and children and boys and youths and old men, he had to sanctify every age by passing through each age. Apparently, he couldn't forgive babies, youths, or old men at all, unless he too had been a baby, youth, old man at all. Science. He also rails at length against those Christians who say that Jesus' ministry only lasted a year. Quote, "For how could he have had disciples if he did not teach, and how could he have taught unless he had reached the age of a master?" He adds, "We know from the Gospels that Jesus had reached the advanced age of his 40s, since in John 8:57, his Jewish opponents retort, 'You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?' And if he had been in his 30s, they would have said, 'You are not yet 40 years old.'" Besides this airtight logic, Irenaeus declares that all the presbyters in Asia Minor testify that Jesus lived to old age as well, and they all knew the disciple John, and John conveyed to them that information personally. And some of them, moreover, not only saw John, but the other apostles also, and they told them the very same thing. So who are you going to believe? Them? Or some guy who never even saw the apostles? Though if John the disciple really existed and wrote the fourth gospel, why doesn't it mention that Jesus lived so long? Why didn't any of the other gospels? Elsewhere, Irenaeus informs us that Jesus had been crucified by Pontius Pilate and King Herod. But in the 40s, during the reign of the Emperor Claudius, that was 41 to 54 CE, not during the reign of Tiberius, which was 14 to 37 CE, as per Luke 3:1. He also says that Pilate was governor under Claudius, even though in reality he'd been deposed by Tiberius in 36, years before Claudius came to power. Irenaeus makes other odd errors too, but it's not like he was researching history. He was just playing connect the dots with Scripture. He, quote, "knew Jesus was around 30 in the year 29 CE, since Luke 3, 1 and 2, and Luke 3:23 told him so. And thanks to Christian logic, he knew Jesus had to have been pushing 50 when he died, since John 8:57 said so. Sort of. Ergo, Jesus had to have died sometime in the 40s during the reign of Claudius. And since all the Gospels knew Pontius Pilate had crucified Jesus, Pilate was clearly still governor then too. Hooray for scriptural math. Other Christians went the other direction. As mentioned earlier, see chapter 5, the 5th century Christian heresy hunter Ephinaeus tells us about an early Jewish Christian sect called the Nazareans. In his heresy-fighting guide, the Panarion, or the Medicine Chest, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, he says, "These heretics worship Jesus Christ as the Son of God, but in all other ways were still practicing Jews." Does Nazarean sound familiar? In Acts 24:5, Paul is accused of being a ringleader of the Nazareans. It's one of the original names for the original Jewish believers in Christ, or at the very least of the early faction, derived from the original church led by the Jerusalem Pillars, Peter, Cephas, John, and James. Ephinaeus says, before the term Christian became used in Antioch, if Acts 11:26 is to be believed, everyone called the Christians Nazareans. However, Ephinaeus reveals a startling fact about these early Christians. He implies that they held Jesus had lived and died during the time of King Alexander Janaeus. But that Hasmonean king reigned from 103 to 76 BCE, or about 100 years before Jesus was born, according to the Gospels. The Babylonian Talmud not only confirms this, its Jewish authors, east of the Roman Empire, where this Talmud was compiled, don't appear to have known any other form of Christianity. How can that be? How can the descendants of the original Jerusalem Christians have ever thought that Jesus lived a century too early. Neither development seems believable, unless, of course, there had never been a historical Jesus. If that were the case, all bets were off, and his place in history simply depended on the storyteller, which might also help explain why our sources either give Jesus no time frame or a conflicting one. It would also explain otherwise cryptic inconsistencies from gospel to gospel, such as his changing relationship with John the Baptist. Were they perfect strangers, as noted in John chapter 1, verse 31 through 33? Were they relatives, as noted in Luke 1:36? Did they even live at the same time? Compare Matthew 11, 2 and 3 with Matthew 11, 11 and 12. Well, none of this helps our travel plans. Looks like we'll have to use the same time-honored techniques the early church fathers used to find their dates of Jesus' biography: scriptural exegesis and guesswork. Jesus' two contradictory nativity accounts are off by more than a decade, and both are hopelessly mythical, even for Jesus. Perhaps we'd have better luck trying to pin down the other end of his timeline. Unfortunately, trying to determine the date of Jesus' death is also problematic, even with these church-approved methods. Like so many of our facts, quote-unquote, facts about Jesus, it becomes a guessing game based on clues from the Gospels. Basically, it would have to be when Pontius Pilate was prefect of Judea, from 26 or 27 to around 36 or 37. If the synoptics are right, and John's gospel is wrong, it must also be a year when Passover, the 15th day of the Jewish month Nisan, fell on a Friday, which means either the year 27 or 34 CE. But if John is right, and all the other gospels are wrong, then it could only be a year when Passover fell on a Saturday, so either 30 or 33 CE. Let's try the latest date first. Next stop. First stop, just outside of Jerusalem, Passover, 9 a.m., 34 CE. It's a sunny spring morning. The sun has risen over the mountains of Moab beyond the Dead Sea to the east and crested the high city wall standing before us. We've arrived just north and west of the Gennath Gate. Though no one seems to know exactly where, and modern guesses vary considerably, Golgotha should be around here somewhere. If this is the right year, Jesus should be getting crucified right now. But that looks impossible, considering what we're seeing. Everywhere we look across the chalky terrain, there are tents, thousands of them. Throngs of cloaked pilgrims, not just from Judea, but from all over the world, have set up camp around the city to attend the 8-day festival of Passover. This morning, the temple is packed with devout Jews attending priestly ceremonies. We spot a pair of bored Roman soldiers keeping watch near the gate. Maybe they can help. Getting closer, we see they aren't actually Romans. A provincial governor of Pontius Pilate's class doesn't rate Roman legionaries. He has to keep the peace with cohorts of auxiliary troops, primarily locally recruited Syrians and Samaritans, under the command of a Roman tribune. When we ask if there's been any execution scheduled for today, they look at us like we've been out in the sun too long. What? This weekend? Don't you know where you are? You picked a bad time to visit Jerusalem. The Jews aren't doing anything this week but lots of praying to their God. And eating lots of lamb, his buddy chimes in. So there hasn't been any trials, no disturbances in the temple, no big parades welcoming the Messiah, you know, the King of the Jews, you ask? Their expressions darken. That sounds like zealot talk, one mutters, slipping his hand to the hilt of his gladius. Stand down, Flacius, the other says, putting a reassuring hand on his comrade's arm. I don't think these two are packing Sika knives. Relieved, I ask, say, you two haven't heard any crazy stories from previous Passovers, have you? Earthquakes, supernatural darkness, all the dead saints coming back to life and crawling out of their tombs? They're staring at us with increasing incredulity, and you quickly elbow me and we beat a hasty retreat. The only thing left to do is to try the Passovers in the only other suitable years, 33, 30, or 27 CE. Long story short, we do, but the outcome is the same. No dice. Our imaginary journey seems over almost as soon as we've begun, but all is not lost. As long as we're ransacking popular fiction, let's say we also picked up a handy alethiometer autopilot from Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, and only now just remembered we packed it. We'll ask, where do we go to arrive at the birth of Christianity? Next stop, south of Gaza, late October 332 BCE. And the story continues from there as they sort of pinball backward in time several hundred years. It's a fascinating way to frame the explorations into whether or not there was a historical Jesus. It's a clever way as well to reveal just how crazy the story is and how convoluted and contradictory and how all these accounts clash against each other. It's just wild. David Fitzgerald's book is called Mything in Action. I encourage you to check it out. And again, thanks today for being on the show and allowing me to read from the book. Okay, next Tuesday, we're talking about recovery from addiction, 12-step programs, religiously motivated or themed recovery programs, as opposed to non-religiously themed recovery programs. If you have a perspective on this, you can send me an email to podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Hope you have a fantastic week. I'll see you back here next Tuesday.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.